In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stevens Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest this time around is Steve Diggle, founding member of the long-running English punk band Buzzcocks. This year saw the release of the band's 10th studio album, Sonics in the Soul, which features our recent coolest song in the world, Manchester Rain. We'll hear a portion of that now, followed by my chat with Steve Diggle on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Solve a problem you can't explain. Standing on the corner, standing in the Manchester rain. And you catch a dream, you just can't find it. And you catch a star that calls your name.
Mighty Manfred here in Little Stevens Underground Garage, and my guest today for our coolest conversations is Steve Diggle of the Buzzcocks. He was a bassist initially, but after Howard Devoto departed, he switched over to guitar, and since the passing of Pete Shelley, he's fronted the band. Their latest album, Sonics in the Soul, came out this past September, and it features our coolest song in the world this week, Manchester Rain. How are you, Steve?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, Manfred. Yeah, we're on tour over in the UK at the moment, but it's all going well.
Excellent. Well, I mentioned Manchester Rain is our coolest song. You're a native of the city. Do you get a chance to spend much time there these days?
I'm from there, but I've lived in London for a while now. But I've spent most of my life in Manchester. I was, you know, born and raised there. That's what made me really, you know. You can take the bar at Manchester, but you can't take Manchester out of the boy. That's what they say. I mean, this track, Manchester Rain, when we did a tour a couple of years back, pre-COVID, I was just going in the stage door to do this gig, and there were some kids outside, young kids. They wanted me to sign things, and they said, "We're going to start a band, Steve." And I looked at them, and I thought, that was me 40 years ago, you know. They had the hopes and dreams. But also, Manchester Rain, you know, it's a metaphorical rain, really. It's just about finding yourself in life and finding how you can deal with the world or your place in the world somehow, you know. Not about fame, about kind of just being able to deal with things in life. So it was that. So then we were standing on the corner, standing in the Manchester rain. And that's how the song came about, you know.
I know you were asked to play bass initially in the band. You switched to guitar. You're around, what, about 21 then. Had you played in bands prior to the Buzzcocks?
Oh, no. I was kind of rehearsing down the road with a couple of guys. And, you know, I wrote this song, Fast Cars, and a few other songs. But these guys didn't mean it, really. So I phoned somebody out of the paper, and I went down to meet them. And by mistake, I met Pete Shelley and Howard Devoto at the time. Malcolm McLaren introduced me to them at the first Sex Pistols gig in Manchester. So the person I was supposed to meet, the person they were supposed to meet, I mean, they're probably still waiting there now outside the Free Trade Hall. Somebody should tell me.
So you really didn't know. I'm sorry, I was going to say.
Don't know what happened.
You really didn't know Pete Shelley and Howard Devoto before They were introduced to you.
Yeah, I didn't know them. No, Malcolm McLaren, the Sex Pistols were playing in Manchester. I mean, I think Howard or Pete had brought them to town. They'd saw them in a little club that was kind of unknown, and they brought them to Manchester and put them in this club. You know, they said, if you come to Manchester, we'll book a gig at this hall. And so I'm standing outside the hall, and Malcolm McLaren's saying to me, they're in here, the Sex Pistols. And I kind of said, well, I know they are, but I'm Star Mel Band. And he said, oh, they're inside here. So he took me inside, because I was going to go to a bar around the corner. I wasn't going to go to the gig. And Pete Shelley was collecting tickets on the door. Well, I said, okay, I'll see you in the bar upstairs. I'll never talk about this band, you know. Because I was a former band, kind of like The Who, 3-minute songs and smash the guitars and tell the audience where to go. And so me and Pete Shelley were talking upstairs, and I thought, some of this doesn't make sense. But anyway, we got on really well. And the next day, me, Pete and Howard all rehearsed through one little amp, this screaming fast music. To quote Yeats, a terrible beauty was born. And the guy the guy I was supposed to meet, and the guy they was expecting, we never met them.
Well, you mentioned hoping to start a band, sort of Who-like and smashing guitars. Figuring like the late 60s, 69, you were about 14. What sorts of music, bands, artists were you really into at the time? Mainly the Who,
lots
or
of
what
groups,
other groups?
Really. I mean, I only say The Who because I used to go to this... I used to live in this house of acid. We was all taking acid at the time, back in the 70s. And, you had bands like Yes and all the progressive bands that, you know, seemed to go on. Every song was like the side of an album. So I started to listen to the 3-minute songs like The Who's Meaty Beaty, Big and Bouncy and stuff like that. But I actually grew up, my cousin had Little Richard Records and Chuck Berry. So I was a child of all that. And then the Beatles came along in 62 when I was 7. And so I got heavily into the Beatles and the Stones and the Kinks and the Who. So, and Bob Dylan, you know. The girl across the road, my mate, when I was 7 years old, she had the first Beatles album and the first Bob Dylan album. Well, I kind of got the Beatles. I can, you know, the tunes and the melodies. P.S. I Love You, all that stuff.
Right.
And there was this guy singing, how many roads must the man walk down? I thought, I'm 7 years old. I don't know what that guy's saying. And they still don't know what he's saying to this day, really. But he's telling me something. So Dylan was a big influence as well, you know. And then, like I say, the Kinks, the Who, you had them all coming at you, one after another, all the great 60s bands. And then later on, you know, it felt under.
We got all this music going on as you're quite young and you have an interest in music. Initially, you play bass in the Buzzcocks for a brief while, then guitar. What was your first instruments? When did you start playing an instrument?
When I was 16, I got a guitar, an old Spanish guitar when I was 16. And but I also had the scooters, the mod scooters, you know. I was also listening to a lot of soul music by then and stuff, you know. And I had the mod scooters up there, have we? And anyway, I lost my scooter license. That's another story. Kind of ended up in jail for a weekend. Kind of told me a lesson. But so I was grounded to this like 6-string old guitar. So every time I put it in tune, you played a chord and it would go out. So then I figured out how to play Beethoven's ninth. Ode to Joy, that one, on one string.
Yeah.
So rather than keep tuning up, I used to jam on a couple of strings and make these little tunes. Well, I realized like 5 years later when the Buzzcocks started going, there's a lot of little tune and guitar motifs in the Buzzcocks songs that are almost separate from the tracks. And so not having a good guitar, that old 6-string Spanish guitar, you know, it paid off in the end because I learned how to do lots of little riffs, you know, individual riffs. So I started playing on that. Then I got, a Les Paul copy guitar, and also got a bass. So, but I was playing guitar really and writing songs at home by the time of 17, 18 and stuff, and trying to write my own songs. And that's what I was doing. And then, you know, trying to be like Jimmy Page for a while because Led Zeppelin were out by that time. And also listen to Velvet Underground as well and things like that. And also Silverhead, do you remember them? 16 and Savage album.
Oh, yeah. Well, here in the Underground Garage, Michael DeBar is one
Michael
of the
Michael DeBar's, yeah. So there was all that going on, you know. It was like the 70s then. And eventually, when I was 20 years old, we met the other two Buzzcocks. And you know, that's how we formed the group, really, the Buzzcocks, you know.
Oh, so when they asked you to play bass, it wasn't as though you had never played a bass guitar before. You had already had a bass
to
play.
I wasn't very good. I was a fraud, really. I was a fraud as a bass player. I mean, I only did 10 shows on the bass, and now DeVoto left, and I moved over to guitar. So I played 46 years on the guitar, really. But the great thing was, then again, using your limitations well. That was the key. When we did the first EP, Spiral Scratch, with Boredom and stuff like that, yeah. I only basically played the root notes with the odd little run in there. So it was a bit like the MC5 and stuff like that, the Stooges kind of feel. So if I'd have been able to play very well on the bass, it would have ruined the songs, you know. The minimalist stuff was, you know, give it the edge, you know. So that's how I played the bass on that. I listen to it now 46 years later and I think, wow, that's amazing bass playing. Because I couldn't play bass properly at the time. I couldn't play guitar, really, you know. But it shows you how fate and twists of things happen and how, you know, using that stuff, or it comes your way in the right at the right time and right place, and it kind of fits.
Yeah. Well, an early tune you wrote, or it was a hit for the Buzzcocks, Harmony in My Head, the top 40 hit over there in the UK in 79. I was reading that something about you smoked 20 cigarettes to get this gruff sounding vocal. Is that true? Or, I mean, were you smoking heavily anyway in those days?
Oh, yes. I still am. But, I read somewhere that John Lennon had been smoking all day when they did the first album. And his voice was going, and he's smoking and stuff. And then he did the vocal for Twist and Shout, you know. We're shaking a baby now, all that stuff. Yeah. And I thought, I want that sound on there. I wanted it to sound a cross between Little Richard, John Lennon, and Steve Diggle. So I wanted that rough vocal. I sang the chorus harmony in my head nice, you know, kind of had it. But the producer's going like, you need to sing the verse. And I'm going, I want to sing it rough, like Tootie Fruity, like Little Richard or John Lennon, Twist and Shout. And that's what I was kind of doing. And because I'd become aware of that kind of singing. Also on the Let It Be film with McCartney, you know. I mean, 1 minute singing yesterday, then he's kind of going, oh, darling, you know, doing that Fats Domino kind of thing he was getting into. So that gravelly voice thing became a rock voice thing, particularly in those days. And so I wanted a bit of that on Harmony in My Head, yeah. Because I'd written songs like Promises, which Pete sang, which I said, you've turned it into a love song. It was going to be Promises about the government and Fast Cars. So they were all a bit more tuneful, but Harmony in My Head's tuneful, but I wanted it a bit more like a freight train coming at you, you know?
Go ahead. Well, your first several albums were pretty successful. You had a number of hits. Why did the Buzzcocks split up in 81? Why'd you guys take the pause?
Yeah, I think the reason we split up, we didn't officially say, right, we're splitting up on this any particular day. I mean, I think we put a lot of records out. A lot of the singles weren't on the albums, you know. I think we'd done three albums and a lot of singles, which became known as Singles Going Steady, because that was our first album in the States. We'd had seven or eight hits over here in England, and we it took us a couple of years to get to the States because we was touring Europe and England. And we did all the singles like that. And to bring America up to date, we did that singles going steady on. But we also did like these three other albums, which were our sort of official proper albums or whatever. And right. And we'd been touring the world, and we had some wild times in America, a lot of parties, the girls, the drinks, and, you know, all the other substances. We had a ball. But I think after about 5 or 6 years, like a lot of groups, the wheels started falling off the wagon. You know, we was a bit tired. We needed to take a break. And and that's what we said we'd do. But the break became a lot longer than we thought, you know. And I think we did some kind of tour and needed another break, you know, and really that's, it was like, you know, it had to stop for a while, you know, and that's what happened, really, you know. And Pete went off and did an electronic album, and I went on and did a band, formed a band called Flag of Convenience. So through the 80s, we did our separate things till 89, when well, I was touring in Europe with Flag of Convenience, but it was billed as Buzzcocks FOC, even though I wasn't even doing any Buzzcocks songs. I was like, I've got these new albums. But Ian Copeland, our American agent, thought we'd go back and said, why don't we do an American tour? Even if it's only like a farewell tour. And so that's what we did. We came back in 89, did a tour of the States, and then we went on to Japan, Australia, and back to Britain, and suddenly it was like we were back, you know.
Oh, good.
I mean, we never said we were coming back. We was going to do like a 3-week tour of America, which, and after about a year, which now it looks like we're back, you know. And then we carried on ever since, you know.
Yeah.
Did the tour with
Nirvana. You described those early days of punk rock as being an age of innocence. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it was innocent, but it was very sophisticated as well, you know. I mean, it was kind of back to basics. It was like, it was primitive, instant, and like the 3-minute songs and very direct, you know. So it was like the rebirth of rock and roll, really, in a way, but it was punk rock and roll this time, you know. And I don't know, it touched an nerve. It went through this country and the world like a carpet bomb, you know. It's just when you get a bit older, you know, that magic when you're young, you do have that innocence, even though you think you know everything and you think you're really old. But that's what gives the vitality of rock and roll when you're young, you know. When you get a bit older, you know a little bit too much more about it. So you have to start, you know, taking a different path or looking at it slightly differently, you know.
Yeah.
But when you don't know too much about it, that's the best time, I think.
Once you guys started playing together in 89, as you mentioned, you sort of find yourselves back and released a number of records since then. So, well, I'm in a band called The Woggles, and we've been active since like 1987. And then in 2003 and 2019, we lost our lead guitar players. First guy passed away due to a bladder infection, and the second one lost his life to pancreatic cancer. And well-meaning people would ask me afterwards, you know, how can you guys go on? Because, you know, George or Jeff was the soul of the band. And in our case, we went on because we felt like to do anything less was to dishonor them and to be less than true to ourselves. With you, Pete Shelley passes away in 2018. So first, how did you deal with that? And then second, why continue on without him as a Buzzcocks?
Well, yeah, I mean, when Pete passed away, I mean, it was very painful because he wasn't just like a band member to me. I mean, we were like mates, like brothers, you know. We were the two songwriters, but also we spent a lot of time together in bars and on the road together, you know, as personal friends. And it was like 43 years we did together. And so I was devastated when he'd gone because me and him had been there since day one, you know, and we'd been on the whole journey. We had a big show to do at the Royal Albert Hall here in London. And you know, he didn't make it. He died. So we made that as a memorial show to him, and we had some guests. But after that, we had a couple of other shows booked, and was kind of, you know, I was in a lot of pain losing him, and you couldn't think straight properly. But then we had these other shows, so we carried on and, you know, fulfilled the contracts of these shows. And then again, it was like, well, it looks like we got back. Because the other two guys, the bass and drummer, have been with us 15 years. You know, they was playing with Pete for 15 years, I mean, albeit not the original members. But so we decided to carry on, you know. From that, you know, we had a tour booked, and I said, we've got to have a new single out in order to make it relevant, because I just don't want to be a greatest hits band, you know. I mean, I don't mind doing anything out of the catalogue, but... And also, so we had a new single out, and we did a tour, and it was quite successful, you know. And also, I've written 60 songs for Buzzcocks, so mainly I'm playing the songs I wrote, really. I mean... I had to drop some of Pete's songs because I felt it was personal to him, you know. Me singing some of his songs didn't, you know, it didn't sit right with me, and I thought they're more personal to him, those ones. But right. There's some we did together, you know, Fast Cars was my song, Promises were my song, but, you know, Pete wrote like a verse for those ones. So I do them, and, you know, we do have a falling of more do I get as well and stuff like that. We carried on, and a lot of the fans said, carry on, Steve, because otherwise there is no Buzzcocks, you know.
Right.
And then you conned yourself and opened. In the First World War, they say when a man goes down, you can't stop, you got to carry on, you know. So that's what I had to do. And then I focused on this new album. So we did a tour with a new single, then suddenly it was COVID.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the new album, Sonics and Soul. It's 11 tracks on there, all written by yourself. You've always written songs, but was it more of an effort to come up with an album's worth of material on your own, or did the pandemic break kind of help with that?
Well, the pandemic break gave you a lot more time, you know. There was no time to go to bars or anywhere else. So it's like, it looks, you know. I mean, I almost loved the pandemic in terms of album writing. I was going to get a bad channel of COVID, you know.
Yeah.
It won't go down so well. But it kind of did me a favor where I analyzed the tracks a bit more. Sometimes when you write a song, see, I'm gone with time, and you think, well, that'll do. We'll take it to the studio. Well, let's get the album done. But I had a bit of time to consider this. And also, I wrote in sequence. After I'd written a few songs, I thought, so we got three kind of up-tempo ones at the opener. Now here's the bad news, we're going down. And then bring it up at the end, you know. So I started to write them so that, yes, we got that kind of song, then we got this kind of one. And now we need another kind of one. So every song sounded different, but you were still on that roller coaster journey. And also I wanted to make it like one of pre-punk 70s albums where... you had to listen to the whole album, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when you read a book, you read it, you start at the beginning, you've got to get to the end to know what the book's about. And I figured that with this album, I wanted people to listen to the whole album to get the whole experience of it, like back in the 70s days with certain albums. So it wasn't just a collection of songs stuck together, you know. I kind of wrote a sequence for the first time. And, you know, I mean, now in the age of just cherry-picking things off the, you know, downloading one single off an album, I don't think you get the thing, you know. So really, you know, I wanted to make an album where it's like a classic album again, you know. You've got to listen to the whole album to get it, you know.
With one of the tracks on there, You've Changed Everything Now. I was reading someplace that... that's like a referencing Pete's passing. Is that correct?
Well, no, I don't know who said that, but there's many things. It's just really, that one, it's just, I can see how people can get into that, actually. But
yeah,
it's just really like knowing somebody And then they change, you know, be it a work colleague or in a relationship. You know, it's like you've known some guy or girl for years, and then, you know, then one day they've changed and you don't see them again, or you don't relate to them again, or they've, you know, everything you know about them has gone. They've changed, you know. And so mainly it was about that, really. You know. It was, I kind of, you know, it's not personal, it's like a universal statement of change, you know. But I can see now people can start reading into B. Shelley's dead and I've changed it or something. But it's right. Just about knowing someone. I mean, particularly in relationships, you know, you're going money right. To someone for years and then they turn around and say, that's it, I'm going, and you don't recognize who they are, you know. Or people that you work with. So it's just simply that, really. It's because the album's called Sonic Sin the Soul. There's a lot of philosophical things going on underneath as well. I mean, I'm kind of thinking, on the one hand, I'm singing to you. On the other hand, I'm talking to you in a voice underneath, you know. So that song's like that. But I do like the lines, on the road you're on and the car that you drive makes me wonder if you're still alive, you know. But that's like an existential way of looking at things. You know?
Well, I mean, you know, another favorite.
Are you the living dead? You know?
another favorite track of mine off there, Just Got to Let It Go. Sounds like you're dealing with some frustration there, right? But maybe that relates back to the underlying philosophies. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, with that one, Just Got to Let It Go, it's just kind of, you know, we all lose our temper, or lose things at times. You know, here in England and here all over the world, you know, people get robbed of their phones and everything else, you know. I think it says, it's so easy to be under attack, it's so easy jumping on my back, you know. Lines like that, you know, it's so easy just to leave me alone, it's so easy just to get off the phone, because people are getting attacked here and people are filming the incidents, you know, and putting them on the you know, on Instagram and stuff.
Right.
So it's about, we all get, generally, on a general level, it's, you know, it's the frustrations of, we all get reach a point where we're going to explode at some point, you know, and you just kind of got to let it go, really. It's like that. It's like pulling back, really, from stuff, you know. But it is also about the kind of, you know, people getting attacked and robbed and stuff like that. Because a lot of street crime, man, there's street crime everywhere, I'm sure, in the States. It's that kind of thing, you know. It's like you've just got to let it go. Just got to let it go.
Experimental Farm, another track on their Experimental Farm, had me wondering if you were much of a fan of the 60s TV show The Prisoner that starred Patrick McGoohan. Did you ever watch that?
Oh, yeah. Yes. I was a fan of The Prisoner, you know. That was quite kind of weird and disturbing at the time, you know, for a TV series. Disturbing in a nice way, in a weird way. But really what it was I was reading this book by H.G. Wells, and it was during the pandemic, because it kind of opened up for a bit. So I flew to Greece, and people were wearing masks everywhere, as we know. And so I was in Greece, and the only book they had in English in the bookshop was The Invisible Man by H.G. Wells. And the other short story was Food of the Gods. Well, I thought that's the only book I can buy because I can't really read Greek. But and it was about, so I thought, I get the Invisible Man bit with the masks. We're all wearing them now. But the Food of the Gods was about this, a kind of scientist who went to like a local country farm and give these simple farmers this substance. If you feed the chickens this, then the chickens will grow bigger. Well, this substance got everywhere, and I thought, this has parallels with the COVID and pandemic thing. This substance, you know, rats were getting bigger, butterflies were getting bigger, and the children that ate the food from this, they grew really large, and they couldn't get it back in their village. It was too big to live in there. So I was kind of wondering what where this story is going. But at the end, it kind of says the tall children it's all the little people making the rules, keeping us out of the village, you know. And I thought, oh, that's the political bit. It's the small people making all the rules, keeping all the big people out. But also, I thought it's also a song about food, you see. You've got like GM foods, and we right. don't know what they're putting in the food half the time. And I try and eat healthy now, so I just thought, it'd be nice to put something about food in there, you know what I mean?
You mentioned you're trying to eat healthy. What is a part of the healthy Steve Diggle regimen? What do you eat to keep yourself healthy?
Well, you know, the avocados, the olive oil, all that kind of stuff, you know. I don't eat a lot of takeaway food. In fact, I only eat for health. I only eat to stay alive. I don't eat for fun anymore. I only eat for something that's kind of good to me, which is kind of boring, but it, you know, it's still exciting as well. So, yeah. You know, I'm a big fan of Whole Foods and stuff. I don't know where I come advertising.
About the album, when and where did you record it?
We recorded it in Tottenham just here in London. And it was kind of in, it's on this big industrial estate. And there's people next door moving cans of fish and all kinds. There's a lot of industry going on there. And I really liked it because a few weeks earlier, I was in Abbey Road, the famous Beatles studio, you know. Yeah. But I do love this one. It reminded me of being in the Bronx or like, you know, I was in a Velvet Underground film or something. I mean, there was all this industry going on in a heavy area. But you kind of opened the door to this big warehouse and there was a, there's a studio there, Studio 7. And also, it's got a 1970s desk, which was hand-built by this krautrock producer called Connie Plank. He did a lot of krautrock music. And but Brian Eno, I think, had used the desk. And Bowie was a big fan of this guy. And I think Bowie used that desk as well. And even Bob Marley as well. So it's got a lot of history, this desk.
Yeah.
And it took him 3 years to find the redwood to put on the top. And it's hand letter set, all the dials and stuff. And so it took him 3 years to find the trees for the top. The components must be that German Telefunken, really good stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see that. I think this desk was built for rock and roll with proper 70s components, you know. And you can feel that when you're using it. So there I'm in the middle of this kind of warehouse estate and going through his 70s desk. And we had two producers lined up. Oh, we had one lined up, then he couldn't make it. And then we had another one. So the manager said to me, why don't you produce it with the guy at the studio, Lawrence Lovelace, whose studio it was, and he knows, and I've worked with him for. So me and him produced it, and that was a good thing because we got a good production combination out of the two of us, you know, which is something I wasn't expecting when we was doing this album. But having worked in studios for years, I know what I wanted, and the guy knows how to put these things down. So we got a good production sound on this album as well, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's give a shout out again to the rhythm section. You mentioned, I think you mentioned Chris Remington on bass, but the drummer, his name is Darry Farrant. Farrant, how do you say his name?
Danny Farrant. Danny Farrant.
Danny Farrant, and they've been playing together with you since like around 2014.
Yeah, it must be at least 15 years now. You know, so they're really tight rhythm section, you know, like a punk slide robbing. we rehearsed the album for 2 days in a rehearsal place around the corner from the studio. Then we recorded all the backing tracks in 2 days. And they was busy. I said, okay, guys, you can go now. I'll see you at the other end. so it took them 2 days to lay down the tracks, you know, with a rhythm guitar. Then I did all the guitars and the vocals after that. So we worked pretty quick. Although having said that, you know, a couple of guitar parts and that took a bit longer. And I think we were doing some shows, so I'd nip in here and there and keep doing bits over a period of a couple of months, I think.
But speaking of shows, I see listed on your website, you still have gigs for December. Mentioned doing playing shows now. Next year, I see a lot of UK gigs. Any plans to try and get over to the States in 2023?
Well, that's what we're hoping, yeah. We're kind of booked up till April here. Or it goes over to this British tour, goes over to April. But I'm on the management's case at the moment to, we need to get back to the States. It'd be great to do a tour there, you know. Just before COVID, I think COVID, you know, the pandemic came out in February. We had a West Coast tour booked for March, so that was kind of cancelled. And it's taken ages for everybody to recoup and regroup and get back, you know. But we're hoping now to sort a tour out for next year, definitely, because I get inundated by the American fans on my Facebook and all the media when he comes to America. And I'd love to come. I love it, you know. And the band's on fire. Everything's good. So,
you mentioned, a few months ago we talked, or you mentioned Silverhead and Michael DeBar is a DJ here in the Underground Garage. And another one of our DJs, Kelly Ogden, she fronts a band called the Dolly Rots. And I know they had an opening support slot for you guys before. Do you remember playing with the Dolly Rots?
Absolutely. I mean, I think they did a couple of tours with us, a few different tours, yeah. Yeah, I know Kelly well. I mean, yes. I think we've done at least two tours they've joined us over the years, at least two. So we're kind of good friends, yeah.
And, good. Well, you know what?
To do some again with them, maybe.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the tune we're going to go out on, which is Venus Eyes. It's the album's closing song. Any one particular person that laid those Venus eyes on you? Any particular person responsible for the inspiration?
Well, we've always looked at those. But in the verse, it says, got a note from Julia, corridors of power, thought control reality in a crystal golden shower. Now, there's a part of a reference to that, to, you know, the book 1984, where you're not supposed to fall in love with anyone. Julia hands Winston Smith a note, you know, and he's looking in her eyes and he's kind of thinking, we're not allowed to fall in love or even, like, correspond, you know. So I put a bit of that because, really, it's a bit about political control, you know. I think little Stephen would understand that one. And he loves a bit of politics, doesn't he, Steve? And so it's a little bit of a reference to 1984 there, you know. But the Venus eyes as well is kind of looking in mesmerized, really. Are we Norman controlled or are we falling in love? You know, it's kind of open, really. I think we've all had a moment where we looked into somebody's eyes, but we all see different things.
I mean,
we can all, I'm sure we've all got memories of looking into somebody's Venus eyes and thinking, well, you know, whether they love you, hate you, or, you know, it's all the eyes are the windows of the soul.
And then there you go.
That's why the album's called Sonics in the Soul. Huh?
All right. Okay.
I wanted to throw it out myself.
Steve, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today on Our Coolest Conversations.
Been an absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Well, we're going to give your tune Venus Eyes a spin now. It's the Buzzcocks off their latest album, Sonics in the Soul, in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
I've got a feeling that's rearranging, a feeling I can't hide.
That was some of Venus Eyes from Buzzcocks here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. The track is off their latest album, Sonics in the Soul. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band Steve Diggle for speaking with me today. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. L.A. singer, songwriter, and guitarist Brian Ray is active as a solo artist, as well as one half of the local group The Bayonets, and he's also a touring member of Sir Paul McCartney's band. Well, Brian has got a new single out now on Wicked Cool Records called On My Way to You, and we'll talk all about it on our next Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Well, I turned around to see your face, but look right.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.